Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What went wrong with Reaganomics? Given the remarkable economic gains recorded during the 1980s, many conservative lawmakers continue to extol the virtues of supply-side tax cuts and monetary policy as a sure and simple path out of the current recession. But one of the chief engineers of the Reagan administration's fiscal policy says expecting the same results now from a policy crafted to address specific issues plaguing the economy then is naive at best and total nonsense at worst. Bruce Bartlett is an economic historian who served as a domestic policy advisor to President Ronald Reagan and as a Treasury official in the George H.W. Bush administration. His new book is called The New American Economy, The Failure of Reaganomics and a New Way Forward. Bruce, welcome to Think.
Happy to be here.
You write that supply-side economics has reached the end of its useful life. What made it so effective during its useful life?
Well, in the 1970s, when I first got involved with this stuff, economists were, you know, completely enamored with the Keynesian view, which basically says that the deficits are good and they stimulate growth. And part of that view was that taxes didn't really matter very much, the tax rates didn't really matter very much, and so when we were dealing with the problems of inflation and stagflation back in those days, the Keynesians didn't really have anything useful to offer, and we came forward with this idea that we needed tight money and tax rate reductions to get the economy moving. Ronald Reagan adopted that idea and implemented it, and sure enough, inflation came down and the economy got moving again. The problem is that both with the Keynesian view in the 1970s and the supply-side view today is that one size doesn't fit all. You have to look at the economic circumstances, and right at the moment, I think we've kind of come back around to the point where the Keynesian view is the more appropriate a way to look at the economy, and that the supply side view is really not correct under these circumstances.
And in fact, you see John Maynard Keynes, who was much vilified during the years that supply side reigned supreme, you see him as a conservative at heart.
Well, that's right. I think people forget what the economic situation and political situation was in the 1930s. Keynes was very fearful that if the capitalist economies didn't find a way to deal with unemployment, that the alternative was some form of socialism, either national socialism or communism or something of that sort. And what he wanted to do was say, well, let's save what's good about capitalism, but modify it a little bit so that we can get unemployment down and save the not throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I think that was the correct way to view it. But then, as now, a lot of conservatives think that anything that goes in the direction of increasing deficits and increasing spending is the first step on the road to Armageddon, and they fight it with all of their power, even though I think they're wrong.
One thing that comes through loud and clear here, and you touched on it a moment ago, is that economic conditions in 1981 were fundamentally different from those that we have in 2009. In the 80s, the Fed was fighting inflation. Today, in fact, deflation is a greater concern.
That's correct, and I think that people don't, even many professional economists, don't appreciate how fundamentally different the government's response to an inflationary situation is compared to a deflationary situation. And one of those one of the key factors is it has to do with Federal Reserve policy. Is when inflation's a problem, it's really pretty simple. You just tighten the money supply. But when deflation is the problem, the Fed needs to be doing the reverse and increase the money supply. The problem is that they cannot reduce interest rates low enough to get people to borrow and get money circulating, because nominal interest rates can never go below zero. So there are a number of studies that have suggested that interest rates really ought to be at a negative 5% right now, which is impossible. So you've got a problem that the Fed can't really do what it needs to do.
So when inflation is a problem and the Fed has made too much money available, prices start to rise, taxes rise, and you have stagflation. Talk about why tax cuts fixed the problem of stagflation.
Well, one of the main impacts of inflation is on the tax code, because we pay taxes based on nominal dollars. The tax code was not at all indexed to inflation back in those days, so when workers got pay raises, even if it was just the cost of living raise, they got pushed up into higher tax brackets. And I remember in those days it was very common to hear workers say, that they would turn down on overtime because they were afraid that they would get pushed up into a higher bracket and be worse off. Of course, that was a little bit nonsensical, but I did hear people say it. And maybe it was just their way of getting off from work. I don't know. but anyway, it causes investors to pay taxes on illusory capital gains, and corporations pay profits on taxes on illusory profits and things of that sort. So the main reason why inflation hurt growth is because of its interaction with the tax code.
We should remind people here what the tax code was like in the 1970s. The top bracket was 70% for personal income tax. By 86, the top bracket was 28%.
That's right. And the capital gains rate was also very high. It was 50% until 1978. Now it's only 20%. So there was no indexation of the tax code at all. It was really very badly drafted to deal with the problems of inflation. And now I think it's much better because of indexing and lower rates on capital gains and things like that. And that's one of the reasons why I don't think there's very much benefit to be gained by cutting taxes even more today, as many conservatives believe we should. I think really the Keynesian remedy that we need to get government spending to compensate for the decline in private spending really makes the most sense to me.
Well, one thing, Bruce, that people also tend to forget is that while Ronald Reagan cut taxes in capital gains and on income, he raised taxes in other areas.
That's correct. It's one of those secrets about Ronald Reagan that all of his supporters have forgotten, is that after the first year of his presidency, when he did cut taxes quite substantially, he raised taxes almost every single year thereafter. And by 1988, he had signed into law tax increases that took back 50% of the 1981 tax cut. So there was still a net tax cut, but much less of one than most people think.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Bruce Bartlett, whose new book is called The New American Economy, The Failure of Reaganomics and a New Way Forward. Let's talk for a minute about the population in 1981 and the population in 2009. In 81, the baby boomers were essentially entering their peak earning years. Right now, they're on the precipice of retirement. What sort of difference does that make?
Well, it makes a huge difference. I think Ronald Reagan, all the presidents up until recently, have had a relatively benign demographic situation to deal with because, as you say, the giant baby boom generation was in its peak earning years. And if you count back 65 years, you see that up until recently, we were looking at the baby bust generation of the 1930s and the early 1940s. So you had relatively few people getting into the age where they qualify for Medicare and Social Security, and now that's beginning to reverse. The first baby boomer has already turned 62 and qualifies for early retirement, and the first one will turn 65 in 2011. And from then on, the problems of Social Security and Medicare just keep getting worse, and the political prospects for dealing with those two giant programs is also going to get worse because the elderly vote in the highest percentages of the population, and they're going to be a larger percentage of the population. So politically, they've really got control of the situation.
So it would be very hard to cut benefits, and that means we're going to have to somehow raise the money to provide these benefits.
Well, that's right. I think that it's extremely unlikely that we're going to cut Medicare significantly or Social Security at all, at least in the near term. Maybe we can raise the retirement age out into the future, but that's just a way of reducing the benefits for that program. And I think that ultimately we're going to be facing deficits year after year after year that are so large that we're not going to have any choice except to raise taxes very substantially.
One of the things you've argued for is a value-added tax. Talk about how that would work and why you think it might solve a lot of our problems.
Well, value-added tax is a tax that every other major country on Earth has. It's a kind of sales tax, but it's different from the retail sales taxes we're familiar with because the VAT is collected at every stage of production and distribution and is embedded in the prices of the goods themselves. And this makes enforcement much better because even if you don't pay the tax on the at the retail level for some reason, you're still paying the tax anyway because it was embedded in the prices of the goods. So it's a very efficient tax, and because it's a tax on consumption and not on investment or savings, it's very good economically. It has a low, what economists call a dead weight cost, and I think that it's really the best tax from a purely economic growth point of view that economists have ever come up with, and it's a major reason why European countries are able to bear a much higher level burden of taxation than we have in this country without suffering the negative consequences one might otherwise expect.
To what extent do you think a value-added tax would affect the final sort of point of purchase price of the goods that we pay for now?
Well, the prices of goods are going to go up by about the amount of the tax, but that's a one-time only increase. It doesn't go on year after year after year. You get a one-time spurt in the price level, and that's happened in every country where this is where they put in that kind of tax. And that's certainly a key reason why, you know, there's going to be strong opposition. I have no doubt that, I mean, you see the way the Republicans are fighting against health care reform. Well, they'll fight even harder against the VAT, so it'll be no picnic by any means. But I think that when the day comes that it's seriously considered, it will be because economic conditions are so bad in terms of high interest rates or high inflation that people will accept the necessity of higher taxes as better than the alternative.
So you're talking about high interest rates and high inflation. This is something that you don't think is politically feasible in a time like the one we're in right this moment.
No, not right this minute. I think we are in what economists call a liquidity trap, and I think that under those circumstances, the government needs to borrow to get otherwise idle funds mobilized and circulating in the economy. But we need to be looking down the road a year or two to when we need to wind that down, or else it will lead to inflation. And I think the problem is that at the moment when the stimulus and the deficits need to be reduced, you're going to have this unprecedented increase in spending for Medicare and Social Security as the baby boomers retire. So we're going to be caught between a rock and a hard place at that point. And that's when I think the option of raising taxes will become viable.
Economic historian Bruce Bartlett is my guest. His new book is called The New American Economy, The Failure of Reaganomics and a New Way Forward. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is economic historian Bruce Bartlett. He served as a domestic policy advisor to Ronald Reagan and a Treasury official in the administration of George H.W. Bush. His new book is called The New American Economy, The Failure of Reaganomics and a New Way Forward. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Bruce, how do you respond to fears of people who say that a value-added tax essentially creates a free pass toward a very big government?
Well, that was a view that I held for a long time myself. The problem is, going forward, that we need the revenue. It's as simple as that. It's not a question of starting from a position of a balanced budget, and if you raise taxes, spending will go up to meet the level of the higher taxes. It's a question of us looking at down at the abyss of national bankruptcy, and this is the only alternative. I think that's a huge difference.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Pete in Arlington. Hello, Pete.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a great topic, and this is a great guest. Bruce, I'm a very big fan of yours.
Oh, thanks.
And I think that you and Kevin Phillips and the people at the Concord Coalition and Pete Peterson and some of the people at his two institutes are putting out the best information of anybody on our economic condition. Briefly, kind of a two-point question. In the 90s, we had very low unemployment, but we were building the tech bubble that burst in 2000. During part of this decade, we also, again, achieved a very low unemployment rate, but we had another bubble, and that was the financial industry bubble with a great deal of leverage. My first question is, have we reached a point, is our economy such in terms of its size and its structure, that the only way we can have low unemployment is to have bubbles which create problems themselves? That's the first question. Second question, really in the form of a request, the biggest problem I have in arguing with my conservative friends is they keep saying that when you cut taxes, tax revenues go up. They do. They just don't go up as fast as the deficit does, and they just don't seem to grasp that. And then you get into static and dynamic modeling and whatnot. If you could publish a simple treatise that would explain all that would help me in my argument with those.
Oh, actually, I discuss that at great length in my book. Not to put in an advertisement for it, but I did discuss that quite a good deal. The thing is that the supply siders, and I was on Jack Kemp's staff back in 1977 and drafted the Kemp-Roth bill. We never said that it would pay for itself. All we ever said was that it wouldn't lose as much revenue as a simple static analysis would say. Now, static analysis would say you cut tax rates by 10%, revenues go down 10%. We said, no, you're going to get some additional growth, so revenues may only go down by 7% or something like that. And somehow along the way, this mythology got created that not merely will tax rate reductions raise revenue, but any old tax cut, you know, child credits, tax rebates, whatever. And I quote in my book a number of statements by President George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and others saying basically that all tax cuts raise revenue, and it's simply nonsense. And I don't know what else to say about that. But on your first question, that's really you've hit on a very, very central problem that we don't really have a good idea today of how to reduce unemployment through macroeconomic policy, except by creating bubbles in the process, a cure that's almost worse than the disease. And we really need to do some serious thinking about this. We need another Keynes, really, to tell us what is the best way to reduce unemployment, because his theory was that unemployment was basically just a growth problem, that if we could just get the GDP, the overall economy, growing faster, then that would per se increase jobs. But right now, I think we've got a disconnect. where employers are so beaten down by losses over the last few years that they are extremely reluctant to hire new workers. And, of course, they do have a lot of additional costs over and above wages for health benefits, which are rising very rapidly. They're going to be getting new mandates from the federal government for health coverage. They're going to be trying to avoid those costs by keeping employment as low as possible. And I think we'll be buying more equipment, labor-saving equipment, more software, more computers, whatever it takes them to do to be able to get more output out of their existing labor force. So I am looking at higher investment by businesses. I'm looking at higher productivity. But I think that those two things, which are in general good for the economy, are bad for creating jobs. And unfortunately, nobody I know of has on either the right or the left has a really good idea of how to increase jobs under these circumstances.
Recognizing that these two things I'm about to mention are not necessarily direct polar opposites of one another, can you compare for us the difference in economic impact between tax cuts and increased government spending?
Well, just in a very general way, tax cuts give you less economic stimulus in the sense of increasing spending in the economy because some of a tax cut is saved. Now, you could devise tax cuts that might increase spending. One that I suggested earlier this year would be to bring back something called the investment tax credit, which gave people who bought machinery and equipment a 10% tax cut for however much they spent on the machinery and equipment. And I think that might have helped. But things like that the Republicans are very much enamored of, like cutting marginal tax rates when rates are already very low. Let me just point out something here to interject something. In the fiscal year that just ended, fiscal year 2009, federal revenues were 14.9% of GDP. The post-war average is above 18%, and we've been over 20% in recent years. So we've had a very, very substantial tax cut. In fact, the biggest reason why we have a deficit is not because of higher spending, but because of lower revenues. So it just seems to me, again, to repeat myself, implausible to continue to believe, as Republicans say every day, that we need to cut taxes even more. There's just no evidence that lower revenues are helping or that more tax cuts would do any good.
Another point you make here is that the only tax cuts that do seem to have a substantial impact, a positive impact on the economy, are the ones that are permanent. And that is a major flaw in the cuts that were put into place under George W. Bush.
That's exactly correct. That was one of the key things that we argued, that the original supply-siders, the first time we really kind of came together and tried to do something in Congress was when, some people may remember, Jimmy Carter proposed a $50 rebate back in early 1977 as a way of getting the economy moving. And we made the argument that only a permanent tax cut actually does any good because it takes time for people to change their behavior, change their incentives, and act upon the increased rate of return to saving, work, and investment, and so on. And so the permanence of taxation was a very, very important part of the supply-side model. And as you say, all of the tax cuts of the George W. Bush years were temporary. They're all going to expire next year. And I think that's one of the reasons why those tax cuts didn't have much of any stimulative effect that anybody can point to. So I think he was not following supply-side strategy in that regard, but some other theory. I don't know what.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Bruce Bartlett is my guest. Let's go next to Irving and speak with John. Hey, John.
Yes. One comment and one question. Dr. Bartlett, I'm very impressed by your setting out of the terms of taxes here. I took a lot of economics in undergraduate work, but did not continue in the field because went to history instead because I thought it was so driven by, in the public sense, ideology. And to hear you say that Reaganism when you actually started with the Reagan administration, does not have all the answers now. It just impresses me very much.
Thank you.
You have that kind of flexibility.
And did you also have a question, John? Thanks for your comment.
Yes, second. Thomas Friedman recently wrote that we as citizens should really think about paying higher taxes just because we are citizens and need to support the things the government does well. I just wonder, do you think it would be that difficult to convince U.S. citizens that, yes, there are cases where we need to pay more tax, as you're suggesting already?
Well, I think circumstances will change, but you're sure not seeing any leadership on this issue. One of the things that concerns me a great deal is that is the vast number of people now who pay no income taxes at all. In the most recent year for which I have data, 47% of all the people who filed federal income tax returns either paid nothing or got a refund, a net refund, because of things like the investment tax credit. You know, they actually had a negative tax liability. And I think it's just wrong as a matter of democracy for such a large percentage of the population to pay nothing to cover the basic costs of government. I mean, things like national defense benefit everybody, and I think everybody ought to contribute something towards it. And I think you also end up with some policies that the people wouldn't otherwise support if they had to pay for them. I wonder whether we would be so deeply involved in Iraq and Afghanistan if we weren't just paying for it out of deficits. If people thought they had to pay higher taxes for such things, I think we would be much less involved in such places.
One thing that you say is important for the GOP to consider is that if the leadership doesn't acquiesce to some kind of tax increase, it essentially keeps them out of the debate, because if they're not on board, then it gets done by Democrats who will overwhelmingly be influenced by those on the far left.
That's right. Think about the health debate that we're having right now. The Republicans refuse to participate, and that means that the people in the Democratic Party who are very strongly in favor of a public option have to be acquiesced to, have to be given what they want. Whereas if moderate Republicans who are against the public option but do think support other aspects of the health reform were willing to give their votes to the president, then we would have a very different dynamic politically, and we would get very different legislation that would be more moderate and perhaps have broader public support. And I think the same thing is going to happen on taxes when the day comes that taxes have to be raised very substantially. The Democrats are going to say, let's just soak the rich. You know, let's just raise tax rates back up to where they were during World War II or whatever. I mean, rates have been over 90% in during the Korean War and up until the Kennedy tax cut. And I think that would be bad for the economy, bad for the country. But if the Republicans are not willing to support some alternative method of raising taxes that would have less of a negative effect on the economy, then that's what we're going to get.
You don't think even the most liberal Democrat in Washington would go back to a 90% income tax rate for anyone, do you?
I'm not so sure. Obama's already said he's going to allow the tax cuts for the wealthy to expire the end of next year. So that will raise the top rate back up to 39.6%. And in at least the House version of the health legislation, they have a 5% surtax on the wealthy that would raise that rate even more. In the Senate, they've got a tax. They're going to uncap the health insurance tax and add an increase that rate. You've got a lot of other things being under discussed for the wealthy to pay more. I'm not really sure where that ends, given the fact that the wealthy did do very, very well over the last few years, and I think that somewhat higher rates are not out of the question. I just worry that we're going to keep going to the point where they do become a negative drag on growth.
Bruce Bartlett's new book is called The New American Economy, The Failure of Reaganomics and a New Way Forward. Let's go next to Sam in Euless. Hello, Sam.
Yeah.
Hi, go ahead, please.
My comment is, why not they cut spending down, defense spending, I repeat, defense spending. That's a 1,000-pound gorilla monster eating up our national economy. And then why can't the federal government go after the big CEO when they have overseas bank accounts? And like he said, that they made a huge wealth during the last 10 years. So why can't they go after them and bring home all the lost economical tools?
Thanks.
And the Senate, the member of Senate and the Congress, why can't they sacrifice their salaries or state legislature? Why not to start sacrificing from the government, the lawmaker, than to hurt the regular common denominator?
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Bruce?
Well, the short answer is that the magnitude of our fiscal problems is so great that even if we did all those things, it would barely be a drop in the bucket. I think there is room to cut defense spending, but we'd have to pull out of Iraq and out of Afghanistan. And, of course, the Republicans don't want to do that. And it looks as if Obama is reluctant to do that also. I mean, he's talking seriously about sending more troops to Afghanistan, and it costs us something like $1 million a year per soldier in the field. So that's very expensive. But, I mean, at some point, we have to have a national defense. There's a limit below which we can't go. And so even if we did all those things, we're still facing deficits that would be very, very crippling to our economy when the baby boomers retire, as we talked about earlier.
Bruce Bartlett is my guest. The new book is called The New American Economy, The Failure of Reaganomics and a New Way Forward. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is economic historian Bruce Bartlett. We're talking today about his book, The New American Economy, The Failure of Reaganomics and a New Way Forward. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who asks if you would talk about what you think the differences are at the individual level between Americans and Europeans that would allow Europeans to approve forward-thinking methods of taxation like the VAT without requiring economic desperation or collapse.
Well, I think a key reason is that Europeans feel that what they get from government is, in a sense, goods and services. In particular, almost every European country I know of has some sort of national health insurance. So the money that they send to the government in terms of higher taxes is really just the same money that we send to insurance companies to pay for our health insurance. Think about it this way. Suppose you're paying, whatever, 5% of your income, your wages, for health insurance, and it's deducted from your pay by your employer. But suppose your employer didn't provide your health insurance, you got it from the government and paid 5% more in taxes, you see? You really wouldn't be any worse off than you are now, but you'd be paying 5% more in taxes, you see? And that's essentially the way the Europeans look at it, is that they're getting something of value from their government that they're willing to pay for, whereas I think Americans tend to view their taxes, especially their federal taxes, as just money down the drain. I think they have a different attitude about local taxes because they feel they're getting something tangible in the form of schools and fire protection and police protection. But at the federal level, I think a lot of people feel that they're really getting nothing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Grapevine, where Barbara is on the line. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Well, two things just now. I totally agree with him about the taxing for national health insurance. But my thing is, he said a little bit back about people getting refunds on their taxes. Well, I am not a good saver. My husband is neither. And when he was working, which he's been unemployed for nearly a year now, we would not declare any dependents, and we'd have $1,000 or $2,000 that we get as a refund. But we still paid our fair share of income tax. It's just that, you know, we're idiots that can't save. And there's a lot of us out there like that.
No, I was talking about something a little bit different. What I'm talking about are people who have a zero tax liability. They owe nothing at all, but yet they still get a check from the government. They have a negative tax liability because things like the earned income tax credit are refundable even to people who owe nothing. So I'm not talking about people who had over withholding and ended up at the end of the year with more money taken out of their pay they ended up owing. I'm talking about something completely different.
And those tax laws are created essentially to spare the poorest, working poor among us from tax burdens. But in fact, they often extend up into the middle and even upper middle classes.
Well, that's right. And I don't in principle have a problem with the earned income tax credit. It's just that what we've been doing over the last few years, especially under the Republicans, is adding many additional tax credits to the tax code. Or, you know, we got child's credits and, you know, I forget what Obama's tax credit is called, work savers and credit or something, I forget. But anyway, the consequence of all that has been to greatly reduce the number of people who have a net tax liability at the end of the year, and that's where we get that 47% figure. And I guess, theoretically, once we get above 50%, you know, there's nothing to stop people from just voting themselves something for nothing.
Let's go next on the phone to Kyle in Arlington. Hi, Kyle.
Hello, how are you today?
Fine, thanks.
My question was for Bruce, and I think it was just answered in the last viewer's or listener's question, is that I was just wanting to comment on the 47% of taxpayers that don't pay taxes.
Income tax.
My income last year was $214. I paid $45,000 in federal tax, but I still got a return for $2,400. So I think you answered that, but if you can expand on that, that'd be great.
Well, again, as I said, when I'm talking about your tax liability, I'm talking about the bottom line on your tax return of what you owe net. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people think of, you know, whether they had to send a check to the government on April 15th or got a refund because they had over withholding. That's what they're thinking about. And I'm talking about the actual taxes that they ended up paying at the end of the day on their income tax returns. And perhaps it's a problem of our tax system that people are not as aware of the taxes they pay as they should be.
I want to go back to something that we touched on briefly earlier. Can you talk for a minute about what happens when we consider economic stimulus in a crisis or at any other time separately from fiscal policy?
Well, clearly we are in a crisis situation, and I think it take too long for me to kind of go through all the economics of why stimulus works, but I just think that when your house is burning, you know, you don't worry about the water damage from the fires. You deal with that later. And right now, I think we were in a crisis situation. Something had to be done. I think we were on a downward trend that really had no natural stopping point, and we had to put out the fire, and I think that's what we did with the TARP program last fall and the stimulus earlier this year, and now I think a lot of people just have this idea that we would be doing just as well if we hadn't done all those things. That's like saying the fire would have burned itself out if we hadn't put it out. I don't quite understand the logic of this, except that people just don't want to believe, what seems sensible. I don't know what else to say.
How well do you think our lawmakers understand economic theory and the implications of the policies that they're creating?
Very poorly, I'm afraid. Since the days I worked on Capitol Hill, I have the sense that there's been a rather dramatic decline in the quality of the staff and the quality of the advice that members of Congress get. And I think they rely very heavily on media-oriented talking points that often come from Fox News and places like that to shape their perspective. And I think it's very worrisome when people like Glenn Beck are essentially telling members of Congress, you know, what their philosophy should be, because Beck's an idiot, and anybody who listens to him is definitely not going to be doing sensible things.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Paul in Garland. Hello, Paul.
Thank you. I think I heard on your show, actually, an advocate once who said that we should just do away with the IRS and tax consumption, give everybody a cost of living check once a month, and use consumption tax to get revenue for the federal government. I was wondering, is that a viable alternative? Does that work out numerically?
Well, what the caller is talking about is something called the fair tax. But it really wouldn't work at all, and I've written long articles explaining why. And I really don't think we want to set up a new entitlement program where the government is mailing checks to every single American every single month. I mean, that would be open to enormous political manipulation for buying votes. And the fair tax rate that these people keep talking about of 20-some percent wouldn't come anywhere close to providing enough revenue. It's simply a silly idea that the numbers don't add up, and it really makes absolutely no sense at all.
Is it possible, Bruce, to refine the tax code appropriately and keep it nimble enough to respond to changing economic conditions and simplify it overwhelmingly in the way that seems to be so appealing to people who look at these problems and can't quite understand what it is we're paying for and how and when?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that we could dramatically reform the tax code and make it better. The problem is that every special provision in the code that currently exists was put there by some special interest, and in some cases the special interests are, you know, really huge groups, you know, people, homeowners, people who have children, things like that. But nevertheless, they're going to fight to keep whatever they think benefits them, and they're going to be very reluctant to give that up. And when you add everybody up together, you're left with a gridlock situation where everybody knows where we want to go, but it's impossible to get from here to there.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak with Jonathan in Garland. Hey, Jonathan.
Yes, I was just wondering why the rich shouldn't take a bath. It was their greed that basically caused most of the problems that we're dealing with now. The poor who are paying for most of this are the ones who need a break.
Well, it's simply because the poor people don't create jobs. Poor people don't found companies and hire people and do the investment and create the growth. We need the rich, and I don't have any problem with them paying somewhat more than they're paying now, but I just think we have to be very careful about throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and I think that there is a limit to taxation. And I don't think we're there yet, but if trends continue, I think we could have a serious situation in which you do see in some other countries where all of their best and most productive citizens are leaving.
Can you give us a quick rundown of how you think the Obama administration is handling the crisis?
Well, I think that they did about as good a job as could be expected with the stimulus, although I think they grossly oversold it. And perhaps even in their own minds underestimated the impact. Where I fault the administration is not so much on what it's trying to accomplish with health reform and energy and environment as that they've taken on too many tasks. I mean, I really think the president should have just stuck with the economy, did whatever it took, took whatever time it took to get the economy straightened out and get some of our foreign policy things straightened out, straighten out the Afghan and Iraq situations before he then got on to all these other issues that I think could have been put off and didn't need to be handled immediately.
So to go back to your burning house metaphor, is the house burning and we're picking out new carpeting for when we remodel next spring?
Well, I think that's a good analogy, and I think I'll use it myself and say it came from me.
How do we get better at recognizing sea changes in economic conditions that call for sea changes in fiscal policy?
Well, that's a good question. Historically, the really big changes have been caused by depressions, wars, things like that. But you can't underestimate our ability to muddle through. And so, you know, to use the overworked analogy, we've got a situation in which the frog is in the water and it's being heated up, but it's being heated up slowly. But once in a while, some crisis comes along that makes the frog jump out of the water. So we're not there yet, but I think we're getting there.
Beyond the fact that in your estimation it has been sort of held on to and preserved for too long, do you have any regrets about the policies that you supported during the Reagan administration and created during the Reagan administration?
Not really. I mean, I think that those were the right things to do then. I think maybe more needed to have been done over the years to try to explain the circumstances and why certain things are appropriate under one set of circumstances and not under others. And a lot of the people that I worked with back in those days are sort of, one-note Johnnies who just keep saying the same thing over and over and over again. And I'm trying in my book to get them to think about why things are different now than they were then. But, you know, political interests are involved and vested interests and all things of that sort. So I do think there was an element of opening Pandora's box, and one of the things I'm trying to do is close it again.
We're talking over and over about the jobless recovery these days, and I wonder if you can talk briefly about the signs that you follow that tell you how we're doing and whether we are, in fact, recovering. Are there particular indicators that matter more than others?
Well, in terms of my own analysis, I'm more into macroeconomic indicators such as the general level of interest rates is, I think, very, very important. As long as interest rates are so low right now, it means that we're still in a liquidity trap. When interest rates start to rise, that will actually be a good sign because it means that businesses are having to borrow for investment and compete for the limited amount of savings available against the government, that will be a pretty good sign. As long as they're not borrowing, that's a bad sign because it means we're still dead in the water. But we're getting, you know, the signs of spring are there. You're seeing, yeah, we got a good number today on housing starts. There's bits and pieces of information that
Bruce, I'm so sorry we're out of time. The new book is called The New American Economy, The Failure of Reaganomics and a New Way Forward. It's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.